RCR with Paul Brennan.
Welcome to this week's Legal Hub feature at RCR. And this week it's around a piece written by John Tukey in lawnews.nz, headlined, What Foreign Investors Will Really Want from the Infrastructure Summit. Last week, the government held its three-day infrastructure investment summit, with Prime Minister Christopher Luxon proclaiming that New Zealand was open for business. The summit attracted investors from home and abroad who collectively manage about, get this, $6 trillion in funds. More than 100 organisations from 14 countries heard from government ministers who showcased areas in their portfolios where there are investment opportunities, and some deals have already been submitted on. For example, the planned Northland Expressway has attracted at least one bid from an Italian investor, and deals were being discussed on the ground at the summit as it was in progress. John Tukey is a professor of construction management at the Auckland University of Technology School of Future Environments. He's with us to talk about foreign investors and what they would have taken away from the summit and how we might benefit from it. John, thanks for coming back on RCR.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Okay, let's start with the money first. I think in a piece that you wrote in Law News, $204 billion infrastructure funding gap, and a record for us anyway, though there are countries with a higher debt to GDP ratio of 44.4%. And given that it's the government's goal to lower debt while also cutting taxes, is this approach, what the PPP approach, open for business approach, is it fiscally responsible or is it politically motivated short-termism? What's your view?
It's a useful funding mechanism for some projects sometimes, not all projects all the time, which I would caution against in the extreme. It's basically purchasing infrastructure using, a higher purchase arrangement where you set up a deal over X number of years where X could be between 20 and 40 odd years. And that deal is you pay a usage charge for the product or the service or the infrastructure that you're using. It's been used for funding things like hospitals, bridges, tunnels, you know, new roading, all sorts of things, and you know, also services for things like you know, for the military, you know, dealing with feeding and arrangements and stuff like this for troops.
Right.
But there's a whole raft of these around the world. It's been used. It's very much a method that is used for funding when you don't want to use your own money and you want to, in effect, pay on the never-never.
How did we used to do it? Did we just cough up with taxpayers' money? We didn't have these kind of arrangements and we sort of got on with it still?
Pretty much. That was pretty standard. You either use your current account, whatever you've got in the bank, so to speak, as a surplus, or you borrow it, and you borrow it in the traditional way from bankers and sovereign wealth funds and all that sort of stuff. And you, having done so, you pay interest over an extended period of time. You know, if you think of it as buying a house, you know, by the time you finish paying your mortgage over, you know, 25, 30 years, whatever it may be, you might have paid two or three times the notional value of the monies that you borrowed in the first instance. And hence is the problem. You know, you can do this, but you end up stacking up all sorts of different concurrent expenditures all at the same time, which can make it a challenge to deal with going forward. The UK has got massive problems at the moment, trying to keep on top of the payments that they have gotten to make in order to fund their National Health Service. Yeah. And the reason being that successive governments between 1990 and 2012-13 funded multiple very large-scale hospitals using this system, and now the cost per bed is substantially higher than a traditionally procured one.
So we don't own this infrastructure until it's paid off. Is that basically the concept?
Well, it depends how the deal is structured. You can have build, own, operate, BOO, or build, own, operate, transfer, BOOT schemes. Eventually, you can you can arrange, you can set up a deal to transfer the asset to the ownership of the state in due course, if you wish to do so. But obviously, if you're going to transfer the ownership of the asset, that means eventually that the capital expenditure on the asset has to be fully paid off to the lender in the first instance, to make good on the debt before that transfer takes place. But you can own it. But then, of course, you're taking ownership of a bit of infrastructure that could be 35, 40 years old that's starting to show its age as well. So you're not necessarily taking ownership of a nice bit of kit that you can, in effect, step back and not have to do a lot of maintenance on it. You know, it's something you're going to pay one way or another, come what may.
Yeah, because you don't want them becoming expensive liabilities
No,
all that way
I
down the
mean,
track and dumping it on future generations is essentially what we'd be
well,
doing.
this is it. I mean, if you look at something like, for example, Auckland Harbour Bridge, you know, there's a classic example. New Zealand's classically really obsessed by acquisitional cost. So how much did it cost? And I think at the time when it was procured in the 1954 to 59, over that 5 year period when it was built, I think the total construction cost, because we're using British pounds at the time, was about 6 million, as memory serves. And by the way, the only reason that got over the line was we carved out of the structure an additional lane for foot passage and cycle traffic that was originally incorporated into the design. It was procured, and it was then, having been procured, it went into service, and it was largely paid for by tolling
I
for a
remember
long
going
period
through
of time.
them as a kid.
There you
Yeah.
go, and that's how it was traditionally done. But the problem with those sorts of long-term assets is, as we've got now with the Harbour Bridge, you know, you've got a bit of kit which the original acquisitional cost is not the point. It's through life cost and then and maintenance cost going forward, and it has a finite life. And the bridge increasingly is, as you will see if you do the research, you know, it cannot be reinforced, according to the last lot of reports that came out in 08, 09. So, you know, we're counting down the total amount of time available, and we're going to have to contemplate that sort of major infrastructural expenditure at some point.
Mind you, we get nearly 70 years, I guess, by the time it washes up
For
in
sure.
that ballpark of, I mean, think of the economic enabling of that item.
Well, I'll give you the numbers actually, if you're interested.
Yeah.
Auckland contributes about just under 40% of the globe of the total GDP of the nation. The total GDP of the nation is about 250 billion US, which means that that bridge contributes to at least 100 billion per year US dollars. So
Wow.
call it 160, 170 billion New Zealand dollars.
Kidding me.
We know what happened when that bridge closed down as a result of the incident where the truck hit one of the structural members,
Yep.
or bracing pieces rather, and it closed it for 2, 3 days. And what chaos occurred. Now, you know, imagine a scenario where the bridge was no longer in service for whatever reason. You know, we obsess on acquisitional cost, and yet, if you stopped and considered what would happen if the bridge was not there for use, what would the valuations happen? What would they do on North Shore if you couldn't connect to the city easily, as a for instance?
We know what, yeah, we know where that would
And
go.
so, and all the flow-on effects that would have for the economy are just absolutely enormous.
Yeah,
So
so the
we.
acquisition cost, the original, even the maintenance cost, is nothing compared to the what it delivers.
Oh no, these sorts of bits of infrastructure are there. Yeah, we you have to focus on what they are going to contribute. And I'll give you another example. The Waterview Tunnel, as a for instance. Now, if you look at transit times across the city, I can't give you the exact facts and figures on that, but the transit times across the city have substantially improved in terms of time taken to get to the airport in particular, and so forth, as well as coming in and out of on Highway 16 and so on. These are huge wins as far as the economy as a whole is concerned, and it changes behaviors in so many ways. I mean, I'm sure if you're familiar with the area, you'll know that it changes how you commute and how quickly you commute. If you've got to go to the airport to fly,
It's
or
almost magical when you compare the difference. It's like, oh, am I here already?
it's a wow, what happened there?
No back streets.
But I remember it was literally about 2 weeks prior to it opening, and I'd been sitting in traffic down the Northwestern for months, years actually, because of watching this huge bit of infrastructure getting constructed and getting finished off. And somebody was whining about how expensive it was and all the rest of it. And it's not going to make any difference. Yeah, that didn't age so well, right? And
Ka-ching, ka-ching. It's made a huge difference.
my word, has it ever? And this is what it comes down to. The challenge though is prioritization again. What you're going to prioritize? What are going to be the game changer bits of kit, bit of infrastructure, or whatever it may be, to set up. The second challenge is the duration of the negotiations in order to make these things fly. That Waterview tunnel took at least one full cycle of parliament, if not somewhat more, to go through the negotiation phase to get the financial contracts in place. And then the final thing that needs to be considered if you're doing a PPP, apart from all the technology around dealing with seismic problems in New Zealand and what have you, is the fact that the government changes every 3 years. And consequently, what happens if government XYZ comes in and changes things and wants to nationalize or whatever it is they want to do? And then what? And that has to be factored into your costing.
And we've got to be able to account for that because there may be very good reasons for that that we don't even know are coming in the future. And to be kind of locked in, I see the risk side, but we've also got to be able to have that available, don't we, as an option?
For sure. If you consider, sorry to obsess on Auckland infrastructure, but it's all very local and relevant to this conversation, and that's the discussions around and the preparations for light rail to the airport, which wasn't that long ago. When we were talking about it, very seriously about spending 16, 17 billion or whatever it was, or more. And the realities are that all of that preliminary work has to be costed in, because these sorts of contracts, the only way you can actually put your name, put your signature on the dotted line to initiate the works, is by very carefully costing everything. And I mean everything into the tender, including every aspect of risk that you can possibly get your head around. Because quite literally, risk is what PPPs are all about. You've got to factor in 40, 30 years, whatever, maybe 10 electoral cycles or 12 electoral cycles or whatever. How are you going to cost that in? And in the event that the project gets pulled, how am I going to recoup my costs? So you actually, before you even start doing any design work, you've got to have a pretty chunky contract in place to be able to offset the initial design costs and any IP that you generate in the design work and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's not a quick
Which may have to cover more than realistic eventualities, right? Because over that stretch of time, you've got to try and think of, like you just said, everything that could
yeah, well,
possibly happen.
One of the classics is sorry, I've got loads of these, but again, an Auckland project, which is Wiri Prison. Now, Wiri Prison is a very well appointed, very well positioned bit of kit, and it was put in place with the PPP. Fletcher's were the main contractor. I'm not sure who the funders were, but the point was not that when the deal was put in place. When everything came into being, Fletcher's had as part of their performance criteria recidivism, right? So they were in effect leading the contract. They had to factor in from a risk perspective, cash flow perspective, what the effects were going to be of recidivism of inmates in the prison that they were setting up this entity to provide a service for. And, you know, all of a sudden, they, you know, they're builders who are now trying, you know, got to deal with criminal justice issues and, you know, rehabilitation of offenders and all this sort of stuff. You know, how do you factor that in? How does it get written into a contract? How does
yeah, good question.
Oh, and by the way, we're only going to do this contract possibly once. You know, you don't. It's not like you can go and
so get there's a big cost and effort just to generate one contract.
For sure, it's huge.
Yeah. Critics of the summit have I've seen a few lines, but here's one: privatization expo. That's what it really is. And, you know, you think back to 80s, 90s neoliberal policies resulting in a lot of privatization. We could argue about whether that worked out across the board or for some and not others. But, you know, publicly held assets, they, you know, the people of the country are always a bit worried about losing those assets. Privatization expo, is that just a bit over the top?
It's a headline grabbing title. It's another mechanism of funding. You know, the bottom line, if you're a government, and it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum you sit on, you know, if you're a government, you've got a couple of choices. You can either A, borrow money yourself and increase the public sector borrowing requirement, which will affect the cost of borrowing the money that you seek to borrow. Or B, you've got to get somebody else to front the money in the first instance and pay the fees. Now, so what you end up with as with a PPP or a what in the UK they refer to as the private finance initiative, same thing, is you've got a you would call it, if you're running a budget in a business, an OPEX CAPEX swap, where you swap capital expenditure into operational expenditure. And because it's operational expenditure, it doesn't show up as a borrowing. It shows up as an expenditure, which you can fund from, you know, current account stuff coming in, you know, taxation direct or user pays through some sort of exercise in tolling or whatever. And, you know, you get the infrastructure without having to save for it, in effect. You know, there are benefits that can come from that, particularly if you're a relatively small economy that has very high aspirations. You know, I've said this many times, and it's a bit of a tag phrase, which is we've got 19th century infrastructure, 20th century architecture, and 21st century aspirations. This is, you know, as we look to the future and we look at all the potential issues going forward, we've got massive expenditures potentially that need to be addressed. So, for example, it doesn't matter which side of the political aisle you sit on. If we're going to deal with the potential effects of climate change, retreat from seafront properties, you know, the lowest level of sea level rise over the next 35, 40 years, which is about 400 mils, about 40 centimeters. Even at the lowest end of that, you're going to require to replace something like 140, 150 kilometers of road, 360, 370 kilometers of buried assets and services like power lines, sewage, drainage, water supply, et cetera. All of this is going to have to be funded. You know, power relay stations in the plains around Christchurch, as a for instance, let alone everything else. You know, if you look at where we live as a society, we live on the peripheries of the Pacific Ocean. You know, if you actually color the country, you know, green, where population is a lower density than one person per square kilometer. I've got a slide on it I use for a presentation, and most of the country is green, and there's only a very, very narrow strip around the coastal zones and in the main towns and cities that where population goes up. You know, so we've got all of the problems associated with the first world economy. We're also, we're pretty thin on the ground as a population to be able to provide the infrastructure ourselves. We've actually done amazingly well.
Well, that's what I was thinking right now. We have done incredibly well. And why can't we do that again?
I'll give you a for instance. So the classic one that we talk about is the initial investment back in the day by Vogel in the rail infrastructure. Mm. Okay, and we can talk about the fact that why did he go narrow gauge? We could have gone standard gauge, and we could have got so much more options. And da 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 da. Okay, it was done on the. What we say in the engineering world, it was done on the smell of an oily rag. It was very much not exactly a spit and sawdust exercise, but it wasn't far off. And we put together a proposition which actually has done pretty well considering. What we don't remember is though that the initial investment started taking place in 1875, 76, around that sort of time. Because of financial chaos that struck the markets, so all the money got raised in London or in the UK back in the day, and because of the financial chaos that descended, we ended up with a spike in expenditures that we were subject to, and it ended up creating over a decade long depression, in effect, mini depression that took out the 1890s. In their entirety, and we struggled to recover from for a long period of time, all based on that one big visionary moment where we're going to invest in a major piece of infrastructure. So we have to be quite cautious and not charge into things willy nilly, because we're mortgaging the future to a large degree.
What about the skill base of those required to put this infrastructure in place? I'm thinking of the engineers, the designers, all those folk like you. Do we have enough of them?
There's never enough engineers. I'm not just saying that because I am one. Typically in society, we struggle to produce sufficient engineers. That's why engineering is always on the short skills list for immigration purposes. A recent report by ENZ, Engineering New Zealand, highlighted a shortfall of about 750 engineering slots. And that was before we had a whole bunch of large-scale engineering companies laying off staff because of the downturn in the construction market that's occurred over the course of the last 18 months, year 18 months, something like this. And we've got some very big firms who've let some very skilled staff go because they can't afford to keep them. Now, that's a problem, because we end up with all our skilled people end up heading to Australia or over to Europe or wherever. And that's a bit of a problem. We're still churning out a lot of skilled engineers with a lot of capability, but they've got to have somewhere to go in order to give them the opportunity to earn a crust, and not only earn a crust, but also contribute to the development and enhancement of society. Ultimately, if you want to live in a developed society, you're going to need these folks in the economy, producing and delivering for us. Not so straightforward when we haven't got a steady pipeline. And a lot of the discussions that were had over the summit just now, and a lot of the people who were commentating on it were talking about the pipeline of works going forward, which is a major problem for us.
You just reminded me, I saw a documentary a while back on the Apollo program, and they had to sort out one of the engines because it had this effect where it pogoed the thing as it was lifting off. And the guy asked the engineer, "How did you do this?" The old guy, now about 80, he looked at the interview and said, "Because we're engineers and we can do anything." Thought that sounded pretty cool.
I like that.
A couple of questions, and what they did, the baffles they designed were incredible. Couple of questions to finish up on. Is there any way of lowering the cost of creating infrastructure? Is it smart to do it in a fully mechanized way, or can we get manual labor back into some of the smaller projects? Can we lower the cost of it? Is there any mechanism for that?
Prefabrication of main structural elements using solutions that have been pioneered elsewhere, for sure. The challenge is to specify and to find the systems and the pre-existing technologies that can translate comfortably into a tough engineering environment such as New Zealand. Our seismic situation, the fact we've got large amounts of igneous rock as the base course for a lot of what we do here and so on, makes things hard here. It's not an easy country to build in across the board. We have quite a unique set of circumstances associated with our infrastructure, our geology, the length of the supply chains that come here. We're a small economy, a long way from anywhere. So we have the economies of scale and distance to deal with, internal and external. So when you talk about the issues of distance, we're 2,000 kilometers away from the closest major market. But by the way, that major market is Sydney, and it's a long way away from its other major markets in Australia as well, which include Brisbane and Melbourne and Perth and so on. So we've got that tyranny of distance, internal and external, to begin with. But our own population here in New Zealand itself is small, but it's spread out very thin. So we've got very long economic, I guess you'd call it lifelines. That feed the different cities, and
We all
we
lived in one
just make
place, it would be easier, is what you're saying. If
the
everyone lived in Auckland.
ask any government individual, and they will tell you exactly that. Yes.
Right, a couple of quick things to finish up on. You referenced in that piece in Law News the Inter-Islander Ferry procurement, I think it's fair to say, debacle, given the sums involved. Are there lessons that you've identified there?
The ferry situation, you've got to think carefully about what's going to be the best option. So if you're dealing with inter-island transportation issues, right, you've got two issues. You've got passengers and you've got freight. Passengers, the most cost-efficient, time-efficient option for people traveling between the islands, unless you're a holidaymaker, or even if you are a holidaymaker, is to fly. Because you don't have the infrastructure to that joins point A to point B to look after, you fly that. So passenger wise, flying is probably the best way. When it comes to inter-island transport, I would contend that it's not necessarily a sensible use of funding to make the ferries train compatible. And the reason being, apart from the engineering required to cope with the up and down of the water in the harbors and so on, with regard to the ferry, with regard to the rail, you can actually have a lot more efficient transfer of freight between the islands by running coastal container vessels that would
Also, no
put.
need for actual ferries.
No, not really,
Right.
because if you look at where most freight is going from and to. Right, North Island and South Island, most of it is going from sort of Aucklandy type of area through to Christchurchy type of area, or one of the other smaller destination ports along the road. Anyway, if you are using coastal shipping, it means that you don't have to have all of the truck traffic on the main roads, which reduces substantially your infrastructural expenditure associated with road maintenance, because you just take all that load off of the
So
main
that's hub and
arterials.
spoke, isn't it? That's the hub and spoke concept, with the hubs being linked to by coastal shipping and then spoking out to the.
And what is the bulk of stuff going on the trains? And the answer is timber, cattle, and animals, milk products, and then general cargo. Okay, well, if you think about where most of the animals go to, they're usually going to possibly a freezer works and then off to port of embarkation. You're not shipping it to South Island in order to get out of the port of embarkation in South Island at Lyttelton. You just send it to the local whatever is the harbour it's closest and send it away, and that's what it works. So having an East Coast route where you would go Whangarei, Auckland, Tauranga, round to
Brisbane, yeah, Napier down there,
and then
through Wellington if you have to.
Then you can pretty much achieve everything you want to be able to achieve, and better yet, it also minimizes your infrastructural expenditure.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And finally, it seems that I mean, it's infrastructure is talked about a lot, but in terms of the public, do you think there's enough awareness of how this sort of business is done? Given that there is a national interest, and you know, we can be a bad deal. We're saddled with it for 40, 50 years.
Well, what needs to happen is that people need to be informed of what the issues are, because you know, even if you say that we're going to fund it traditionally, whatever the piece of infrastructure is, we're going to fund this traditionally. That's all good. Even then, you're still going to be paying through the nose for the interest rates on any loans that we take. You know, we're no different. We don't just. It's not like we have a global reserve currency in the form of the New Zealand dollar, where we can just print our problems away. And didn't we do well, like the Americans do to a large extent? No, we're more of a corner shop than we are a supermarket. And you know, the effects are that we have to be careful with things. What needs to happen is that our politicians need to be able to front this sort of conversation and explain things clearly. As I explained with regard to the expenditures around the harbour bridge earlier on, you know, the fact of the matter is you've got a piece of infrastructure which is worth, you know, or contributes extensively to $100 billion of GDP a year. I think actually, if we spent a few billion dollars on a harbour crossing, it would be very, very well spent, because of the obvious quantums of contribution that are made. We, you know, again, we obsess on acquisitional cost and we ignore value of infrastructure that's procured.
Fascinating conversation, John. Really interesting. Nice to hear your thoughts, and it informs us.
No problem at all. Happy to help.